I am very privileged to introduce our main speaker, Dr. Michael Perrini. He is a PhD from Yale, but he talks plain, I hear. Dr. Perrini's articles have appeared in numerous publications, including Covert Action Quarterly Magazine, New Political Science Monthly Review, The Humanist, Dollars and Cents, The Nation, Los Angeles Times, The New York Times. His commentaries are aired on radio stations, television talk shows, and cable community access stations in the United States, Canada, and abroad. His lectures and talks have been received with great enthusiasm and high interest. His books are available today, and he can autograph them for you. The latest, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, and the next most recent, The Terrorism Trap. His various works have been translated into 15 different languages. He's written 17 books and 250 articles. He's a world traveler who recently spoke in Belgrade, Hanoi, and Brussels, and South Orange, New Jersey, he says. He just told me that he was driving along in the car. He wasn't driving. He was the passenger. And he was holding up his cell phone, and he received a phone call from Radio Tehran. And they were asking him his assessment of the California election. Anyway, he wants to make sure that you know, if you don't know already, about his website, www.michaelperrini.org. I am very privileged on behalf of the People's Weekly World, because he has not spoken at a forum of ours for a number of years. This is the first time. And we are very, very fortunate to have Dr. Michael Perrini.
Thank you. Well, you know, it gets embarrassing when the applause you get before you speak are longer than the applause you get after you speak. I'm going to talk about U.S. globalism. I'm one of those people who believes that U.S. foreign policy is not stupid or confused, but it's very rational and it's very consistent. The history of U.S. policy, especially after World War II, but even before, is a history of bloody, repressive interventions. Most Americans would be shocked to hear about this. Most Americans believe that the United States is a force for good and virtue and democracy in the world. The gap, the difference between what Americans believe that U.S. leaders are doing in the world and what these U.S. leaders have actually been doing is one of the great propaganda achievements of the last century. The truth of the matter is, and it's not the United States. I may sometimes lapse and say the United States. Every time I say United States, I don't mean the United States, because we're the United States. I mean U.S. leaders. U.S. leaders profess a dedication to democracy, yet over the last 50 years, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing reformist democratic governments in Guatemala, in Guyana, in the Dominican Republic, in Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries. It's a very incomplete list. Those are the ones I wrote down on the plane, just come to my head. And replace them in each case with pro-capitalist military regimes that open up their markets, resources, and cheap labor. By cheap labor, I mean unorganized labor. I mean underpaid labor. I mean labor that's intimidated by goon squads and death squads. Open them up to U.S. corporate investors on terms that are completely favorable to the investors. U.S. has been active in covert actions and proxy mercenary wars against popular revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. Another incomplete list. Against reformist governments in Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, Syria, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, Afghanistan. U.S. forces with direct aggression and invasion have attacked just in recent years, in the last few decades, Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, North Korea, Laos, either with direct total invasion or aerial attack or both, North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Yugoslavia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq twice, Somalia. Estimated 10,000 people killed in Somalia. You didn't hear about that 10,000, did you, when they did Black Hawk Down and they showed those 28 American boys killed, 28 who should have never been there, and we support our troops. We want to take them and bring them home. That's the real support. You saw that, all that fighting and all that. They didn't tell you that 10,000 Somalians were killed by U.S. jets and missiles and whatever else. Hundreds of thousands have been killed in Iraq. Tens of thousands died every week, all through the 12 years of sanctions. I visited Iraq in 99. When I was there, the bombings didn't start again. The bombings never stopped. The bombings were going on all through those 12 years, two, three times a week. Somebody was getting killed. In the short 7 days I was in Iraq in November 2000, a school was hit and four students were badly injured and two teachers were killed just in the week I was there by American bombs. And that stuff kept going on. 3 million were killed in Vietnam. 300,000 Vietnamese are still missing in action. We talk about our missing in action in Vietnam. It's, what, 1,200 now? Where are they? Where could they be? They have 300,000 missing, blown to pieces, gone, whatever. 500,000 in Laos were killed. And that's not the only victims. There's the victims who survived. There's the victims with shattered bodies, with shattered spirits and minds. There are the victims who lost everything, who spent a lifetime trying to recover from that. 300,000 killed in East Timor by that deranged murder machine known as the Indonesian Army, trained, equipped, paid, and advised by the Pentagon, the CIA, and the U.S. National Security State. 80,000 killed in El Salvador. Finally acknowledged in the New York Times, acknowledged 30 years later, acknowledged that 205,000 were killed in Guatemala. And the president, our peerless leader of that time, slimebag Bill Clinton, goes down and says, "I apologize." Oh, okay. Well, he apologized. That makes it all okay now. 205,000 killed by death squads, by extermination programs, 600 Mayan villages. 600 of these villages, every man, woman, and child in them killed by Rios Montt, General Rios Montt, protege of the School of the Americas, protege of the CIA. Over 1 million people killed in Mozambique. We never heard a word about this in the media because it was a CIA war. Over 2 million killed in Angola in a war that went on for 30 years, which didn't have to go on at all, except that UNITA was equipped and financed by the U.S. All through the Middle East, popular movements, workers' movements, unions, student movements, farmer collectives, all of them destroyed, shattered, battered down. In Turkey, in Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon. Saudi Arabia, that obscenely filthy, rich, corrupt family wouldn't last 3 weeks if they didn't have U.S. guns behind them. The people of Saudi Arabia are ready to get rid of them. And we could go on. 21 countries in Africa that have had enormous amounts of U.S. arms, bribes, all of this, to put in the most retrograde, repressive, and corrupt rulers to destroy every popular movement, every democratic movement that emerges. These people are perfectly capable of democracy. These people are perfectly capable of viable production. These people are perfectly capable of organizing their markets and their labor. They're perfectly capable. They aren't allowed to do it because of this kind of destruction. The destruction of the economic infrastructure, the impoverishment of the people, the destruction of their future. You kill the future of a nation too. And anyone who dares to oppose it or question it is called a rogue state. Now, there's no rogue state. There's no terrorist movement. There's no axis of evil. There's no communist state that has this kind of record. There's no communist red blood menace, you know, say what you want, Stalinist state, that has anything like this record of aggression and destruction and murder and violation of international law. That just isn't. And I say the American people don't know it. All of this, by the way, is a matter of public record. It's not like I got some secret documents that just came into my hands that no one else has seen. It's all a matter of public record. But of course, there's some parts of the public record that get blasted across the media, and there are other parts of it that are thoroughly suppressed. Now, it's not enough to bemoan or denounce this. We also have to explain it. We have to explain why. Why is this happening? We will not convince our compatriots of the wrongful nature of this kind of policy unless we discuss the real intent and interest behind such policy. As long as they believe that this is being done to protect them from some threats out there, they will go along with it. They don't care if their leaders are rough. They don't care if their leaders violate international law. They want them to violate international law. They want them to act like thugs and gangsters. They want them to be tough and brutal and total and decisive. That's called strong leadership. That's called strong defense. When they are afraid, and that is what our leadership has done, is to conjure up fears that there's people out there going to get us. For a long time, it was the communist menace. The communists are going to get you. This is all because of communists. We have to do this. We have to support dictators because we've got to stop those communists. But a lot of these interventions came way before communism, and a lot more of them are happening more frequently, more bloodily, after communism. So it wasn't communism. That was one of the excuses. That was one of the bugaboos that they raised up. That was one of the fears they conjured up so that people will rally around the flag and will do what the leaders want. And we've got to speak to that fear and say, you have a false fear. There are things you really should be afraid of and you're not afraid of it, like poisoning the environment, like going and killing all these people, like putting your democracy at risk, like having your public treasure devoured by a rapacious military and a rapacious corporate America. Those are real things you should fear, and stop fearing some little country. One year it's Noriega, the next year it's Milosevic, the next year it's Gaddafi, the next year it's the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the next year Saddam Hussein. Do you remember Gaddafi? I remember 1980s. In the 1980s, I was going around lecturing, and suddenly I hear people saying to me, Gaddafi, Gaddafi. Everybody was Gaddafiing. Gaddafi. What about Gaddafi? Gaddafi, Gaddafi, Gaddafi going to get your mama, Gaddafi. Where's Gaddafi? I said, what Gaddafi, what? 2 months ago, you couldn't have found Libya on the map. Today, you're convinced that this guy, head of a country of 3 million people, with an army of 50,000, about the size of the LAPD, is a mortal threat to the safety of the United States of America, to the national security. And what was Gaddafi's real sin? I'll tell you what his real sin was, because that policy wasn't stupid when they targeted Gaddafi, and their animosity toward him is a very legitimate one. Here's what Gaddafi did. Gaddafi took a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, where a few obscenely rich families ran the whole thing, got all the money from the oil, and the mass of people were poor. And what he did is he kicked those families out, he and his colonel's rebellion, and he started a forestation program. He planted millions of trees. He started health programs, education, school programs. For the first time in the history, the ordinary Libyans could go to school. That's what he was doing, and he nationalized the oil industry, and he took the earnings from the oil industry. He still sold it to the Western markets. What are they going to do with it? They can't drink it. They can't eat it. Sure, they have more than happy to sell it to the West, but they were getting the cut on it, and that money is what he used, and he gave that back to the people, and that's not what they like, because the difference between the haves and the have-nots, I mean, the truth is, in the conflict between the haves and the have-nots, the haves are really the have-it-alls. They want it all, and they don't want to give a little bit here and a little there. The U.S. government, since World War II, has given away some $300 billion in military aid. Just think what $300 billion. That could solve all the budgetary crises of all the states in the union right now. Just that amount. Aid to train, equip, and subsidize some 2.5 million troops and internal security forces in more than 80 countries. Not to defend these nations from outside invasion, but to protect ruling oligarchs and multinational corporate investors from the dangers of domestic anti-capitalist insurgency. How do we know that's true? Well, by observing, for instance, that with very few exceptions, there's no evidence that these various regimes have ever been threatened by attack from neighboring countries. So why are they building up these military forces? Why are they building up these security and police and paramilitary forces? It's not to make war or defend themselves from another country that's going to make war on them. It's to make war on their own people, to make war on their own working people. That's why. To protect those countries, to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. We also know that that's true because these friendly regimes invariably support economic systems that are subserviently integrated into a global system of transnational corporate domination, open to foreign penetration on terms that are totally favorable to transnational corporate investors. Third, there's clear evidence that the U.S.-supported military and security forces and death squads in these various countries have been used repeatedly to destroy popular reformist movements and insurgencies that advocate some kind of egalitarian redistribution of the resources of the society. So the struggle really is between those who think that the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, the technology, and the capital of the world in every country are there for the capital accumulation process and enrichment of the few, as opposed to those who think all those things are there for the needs and the social betterment of the many. And that's the basic struggle that goes on. The designated enemy, the demonized enemy, pumped up by the media, obligingly following the line the White House or the Pentagon puts out. The designated enemy can be a reformist, populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijo, and even under Noriega, or as in Egypt under Nasser, Peru under Velasco, Portugal after Salazar, when the army officers took over. It could be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democracy popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or Jamaica under Michael Manley, or Greece under Papandreou, the Dominican Republic under Juan Bosch. It could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea, an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Gaddafi, or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907, this was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him. Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state. Now you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people say? Oh, you're Marxist. Oh, you're Marx. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that. I used to hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually... You say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. And I'd say things like, you know, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I say, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I say, you know, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they say all the time. And I say, boy, this guy Marx was really something. You know, here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. That's pretty good. And then I realize something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919, in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, you know, that they use. Political instability, undemocratic forces, we've got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You say, well, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. See, so we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German, and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too. Yugoslavia is a great case in point. I have a book there called To Kill a Nation. Got any more copies of it? Good. See, here comes the infomercial now. We start. There it is. Okay. Yugoslavia was tolerated for quite some time as a breakaway country from the Eastern Bloc of Nations, so-called Bloc of Nations. But after 1990, the U.S. saw no reason to tolerate its existence anymore. I mean, here was a country, a rather large country right in Central Europe, which was not going the way of free market reforms as was happening in Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, and all over. They were not doing that usual thing. They were not, at first they weren't. Yugoslavia had an economy that was 80% state-owned still. Yugoslavia had a high standard of living and a high degree of economic equality. Anybody could go to school to the highest level they want, and medical care was free. Yugoslavia showed no interest in joining the European Union, no interest at all in joining NATO. It had a productive industrial base, a successful auto industry. 80% of the Yugoslav auto market was sold by the Yugo. It had construction firms that competed quite successfully throughout, even in Western Europe. Now, when you destroy all that, you, of course, increase the value of your own capital. If I destroy your firms, I destroy your auto industry, I increase the value of my auto industry. If I destroy your agricultural base, I increase the value and open market opportunities for my agricultural base. And that's exactly what happened. German and U.S. agencies supported every retrograde secessionist and reactionary ethnic nationalist in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo. And today, Yugoslavia has been broken up into a cluster of little right-wing republics where everything is privatized, everything's been deregulated, sold off to private investors at garage sale prices. That's the public capital of the people's labor is now given away to private investors, where the media have been taken over by rich private investors or conservatives. Pension funds have been plundered and disappeared. Public services have been shredded. I was just in Belgrade last March, and I was with a friend, and she said, "Well, I'm going to meet you later." It was a Saturday. "I'm going to meet you later, but I'm going to a doctor's appointment." I said, "What do you mean? It's 7 o'clock Saturday night. You're going to see a doctor? Who sees a doctor at 7 o'clock? She says, "Oh, here in Yugoslavia, the doctors will see you anytime you want because they're so desperate for patients. The public health services are broken down. So people are literally without, unless you can pay, are literally without services." And 7 was a convenient time for her. And the doctor said, "Okay, sure." There's inflation in Yugoslavia now. There's unemployment, poverty, suicide, prostitution. All of this has skyrocketed. And we hear next to nothing about it in the press. It's a free market paradise. It has been brought into the fold of the West. That's Yugoslavia today. And unfortunately, there were too many people on the left who supported that war and swallowed the official line. They swallowed the mass media line right down their throats. They thought they were fighting rape. They thought they were fighting a demon called Milosevic, and they didn't, and they were just ill-informed and taken in. It's much too bad. And I'm including some very notable progressive speakers who swallowed that line, including one who calls himself a pacifist. Okay. Now, some critics say, well, economic factors are not the motive behind intervention, because the intervention often costs more than the investment that the U.S. has there. For instance, in the Philippines, the U.S. has spent something like $7 billion in aid in the Philippines over the last 30, 40 years to protect a U.S. investment that's only about $3 billion. So it can't be economical. It's uneconomical to spending $7 billion to protect $3 billion. You know, Thorsten Veblen answered this question over 100 years ago. He said, what you're forgetting, not about the Philippines, but I'll bring him in now as a voice. What you're forgetting is that the people who pay the $7 billion are us, and the people who have the $3 billion are them. And they'll spend $7 of your money to protect $3 of theirs. They'll spend $20, $50, $100 of your money to protect $1 of their money. In fact, when it comes to protecting their money, your money is no object. Furthermore, it's not just to protect direct investments. It's to protect that whole global system. It's to destroy and suppress any country that tries an alternative, self-defining, self-developing system, that tries to get out from under that enormous global system. So it's not just direct investment. The two most dramatic examples of U.S. direct military intervention, there was very little U.S. money actually involved. In Soviet Russia in 1919-1921, most of the capital was British and French. And in Vietnam, half a century later, where almost all the capital was French, some British. But they went in to stop a competing system that would use the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets in a different way. Not for the enrichment of the few, but for the needs of the many. They went in there to defend their class interests, their class power interests. And that's what it's about. And now today you've got the U.S. saying not only that we want to preserve a global free market paradise, but it's got to be a U.S. global paradise. The U.S. has got to be the only superpower. And we will not tolerate the emergence of another superpower, even a capitalist one. And we will not tolerate the emergence of regional powers. Regional powers can cause problems too. We want you shattered, we want you broken, we want you weak, and we want you hungry, and we want you desperate. Because the hungrier and the weaker you are, the harder you will work for less and less, and the more I get for me. That's the name of the game. The expropriation of surplus value, the expropriation of a whole social order. Capitalism is more than just an economic system. It's a social and cultural and ideological order. And we have got to fight it and defend ourselves from it. Now, U.S. support of police state terrorism and torture, I want to return to my opening point, isn't an irrational policy. It may foster, it may feed off irrational fears, it may feed off irrational impulses, it may recruit irrational impulses, it may recruit distorted personalities who get off being torturers or bombing villages from a jet, you know, and watching them burn and all that sort of thing. It may do that, but its goals, what it is directed at, is rooted in some very rational interests. In every country where the U.S. has gone in and done these things, where human rights, where economic rights, where political rights, social rights have been destroyed by U.S.-sponsored state terrorism, in every one of these countries, labor organizations have been destroyed or seriously mangled, wages have declined, profits have increased, tax laws have been made more favorable to transnational corporations, and the investment climate improves. Iraq is now another case. The Iraqi Revolution of 1958 was only partially overthrown by a CIA coup in 1968. By 1970, the agency of that CIA coup was a group known as the Ba'athist Party. The leader who emerged was one man named Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein then proceeded to murder, torture, brutalize every Democrat, every progressive, every communist, every labor leader, every peasant leader, murdered them and destroyed the progressive forces of that Iraqi revolution, or drove them underground or into exile. Saddam Hussein was Washington's poster boy. He couldn't do any wrong. In fact, he was then sigged on to Iran to go do some dirty work there and try to overthrow this anti-American revolution in Iran. But he also did some other funny things. In 1972, he took an oil industry, which had belonged, back in 1958, had belonged to British and U.S. oil companies. He took this oil industry and he nationalized it. And you know how this infuriates people in the West? You know how this infuriates oil investors? When these people in these countries take our oil, which happens to be in their soil, take it from us, steal our oil from us, that's oil which belongs to us. Well, it infuriated people, and they, there was the Cold War was on, and he was doing other things, so they left him alone for a while. Comes the overthrow of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, scores are going to be settled. It's like Yugoslavia, too. We don't have to tolerate this guy anymore, they say in the White House. Saddam Hussein, I should add, was doing some other things, too. He started copying the left agenda to a limited degree. Not with the same egalitarianism. But he set up education programs. He trained cadres of engineers. He put in public health programs. He did a number of things like this. There are many countries in the Middle East that have oil but no water. There are others that have water and no oil. Iraq was the only one that had both. It had a good ecological base. Yugoslavia did too. It was destroyed by depleted uranium from the bombings, which many of our progressives and liberals supported, those bombings against Yugoslavia. In Iraq, too, the same thing has happened. A very good agricultural base, which has been destroyed by depleted uranium for infinite generations. I mean, what evil is this? How broadly can you define your own interests, and how narrowly do you define other people's interests, so that you can just poison them and destroy them and all that to gain some advantage for yourself, real or imagined? So Iraq had the highest standard of living in the Middle East, which isn't saying too much, but it wasn't that bad. War does some other things too. War also has domestic political advantages. war makes your leader a great hero. You know, we know some of our compatriots, don't we? We know some of our fellow Americans who never stop saying, who are quite capable of saying cynical things. Politicians, they say one thing to you to get elected, then they do something else when they're in office. They talk for the little guy, but they end up helping the fat cats. I mean, you hear people say that. But when those same politicians, wrap themselves around in the flag, and when they point to some evil out there, some threat that's going to come get you, why then our same compatriots suddenly discard their cynicism, discard their skepticism, and with childlike trust, they say, we've got to support the president. We've got to support the president. You know, I heard a student once say to me, he said, that's the difference between you and me. He said, I have faith in President Bush. He was talking about George the First. He says, I have faith. I said, excuse me? You have faith in the president? What are we doing here, religion or politics? You have faith in Georgie Bush? Like my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony. You have a picture of Bush on your bureau with a little candle. You light it, you go, oh, Madonna, Georgie Bush, Bush. He said, well, I trust the president. I said, there too, you trust the president? Trust? Is that what we're dealing with here? Trust, trust, which is something that you should reserve only for your friends and close companions or close family members. And even them, check them all out once in a while, right? You're all laughing, you know, right? No, democracy is not about trust. Democracy is about distrust. It's about accountability. It's about exposure. It's about debate. It's about getting the things out on the table. It's about challenging them. That's what it's about. So perpetual war is very useful to these people. To this slime bag who's president now, Georgie Bush. He wants war all the time. Except this last one isn't going that well, so he's cooled back a little. But war suspends the critical judgment of people. They all rally around the leader. You know, the Germans were doing that, or some segment of Germany was pushing that line. It was called Führerprinzip, right? The leadership principle. That in the Führer, in the leader of the state, there's the embodiment of the state. And what he says is it. That's the expression of our very souls. As Rudolf Hess said about Adolf Hitler at the big Nuremberg rally, he says, do not search for Adolf Hitler with your brains. You will find him with your hearts. Adolf Hitler is Germany, and Germany is Adolf Hitler. And in American idiom, that's sort of what we're getting here. No, I mean, it's that Americans wouldn't go quite for a line like that. But it's say, trust our leader. We have to do this. We're facing these dangers, and we all have to rally, support our troops, blah, blah, blah. And check your brains at the door. Check your critical facilities, and any expression of critical intelligence will be treated as a manifestation of lack of patriotism and treason and cavorting with the terrorists. That's the kind of line that they're trying to feed us. Well, perpetual war, perpetual crisis does that. It's also a way of covering domestic sins, you know. Federalist Paper number 6, Alexander Hamilton, 1787, he said, 1787, he said, many a leader pursues overseas adventures so to distract the people from their domestic grievances. Does that sound familiar at all? And in July of last year, not this July, the July before this one, the Republican Party was reeling from those scandals. Enron, Halliburton, Harkin, all of these things. The Republican Party was seen as the party of corporate scandal. And two of their top leaders, the president and vice president, both implicated in insider trading, so obviously refusing to cooperate, refusing to hand over documents. In July of 2002... By November, the airwaves, by October rather, the airwaves were filled with war talk. Iraq, Iraq, war talk, war talk. The Republican Party now reemerged as the party of defense, patriotism, a strong America protecting us from this mortal threat, this imminent danger, Saddam Hussein, who is going to attack us any day with weapons of mass delusion. And they won a midterm election that they should have never won. Along with maintaining superpower status, and along with these domestic advantages, another domestic advantage, let me mention, as you know, is making the war against democracy, because democracy is a real challenge to capitalism. Democracy was a wonderful invention by the people of history. That's what it was under Cleisthenes in ancient Greece in the 5th century, 4th century. That's what it was in Rome in the late 6th century B.C., and for 500 years, democracy was an invention by the people of history, the ordinary working people of history. I wrote a book about it. It's right there called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. It was an invention by the people to protect themselves against the abuses of wealth. That's what democracy was. It was born in class struggle. And that's what it still is today. And that's why it's very annoying and very bothersome to the powers that be. And a way to get around it is to circumscribe it, to limit it, to intimidate people, to pass repressive laws, all again under the guise of protecting you and saving you from some terror. And we hear that the terrorists are after us because we're rich, we're prosperous, and we're free. And they hate this about us. But you know what? I've been doing some reading. I read an interview of Osama bin Laden by Robert Fisk in an old issue of The Nation, 1998. I just happened to find it in a pile of materials. And he says, America is the demon and is our enemy because they have betrayed us, they've come here, they've destroyed our way, they've undermined us. The guys who tried to blow up the World Trade Center and killed, 200 people the first time, remember in 1993 when they went on trial? They said, we attacked you because you won't leave us alone, because you've come to our countries, you've taken our wealth, you take our land. That's what they say. They don't say it's because, oh, we're just so jealous of you, you got everything and we got nothing. They say, we just want you to leave us alone, we want you to get your boot off the back of our neck. That's why they do this. So I know a way, the best way we could fight terrorism is by undermining and getting rid of the causes of terrorism, by leaving those people alone and helping them in their popular movements and in their attempts to build a better life instead of supporting their oppressors and becoming their oppressors. Don't take my word for it. Everything I've been saying here, don't take my word for it. We always say that actions speak louder than words. There are times when words speak louder than actions. When you're trying to decide what is the intent of an action, where the person can't deny the action, but they deny the intent and they give you another thing. The problem with trying to establish the intent is that nobody's ever seen an intent. Or a motive. It's not empirical. It's not an empirical thing. Intent is something that is only ascribed or imputed or, deducted. You say, well, he did that because of this, I think, and you look at it that way. Now, what's very interesting is when some people, like rulers, come out and actually give the real intent. They don't talk about democracy and this and that. They tell you what their real interests are. Let me read you a member of the ruling class. He was a partner, senior partner, in one of the richest corporate lawyer firms in America, in New York. It was called the Dulles Brothers. His brother, Alan Dulles, served for a stretch as director of the CIA. He himself, John Foster Dulles, was Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. And this is what he says. He actually comes out and he says it. He says, in order to bring a nation to support the burden of maintaining great military establishments all over the world and at home, it is necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. There must be the portrayal of external menace. This involves the development to a high degree of the hero nation versus the villain nation ideology, and the arousing of the population to a sense of sacrifice. Once these exist, we have gone a long way on the path to war. I mean, he's being very positive about this. He's saying this is a good thing, clever thing. That's John Foster Dulles. So they come out and they say it. I want to read to you one other thing. This was written by a man named Tom Watson. He was a U.S. senator in 1898. He wasn't a Democrat and he wasn't a Republican. He was a populist. And the populists were People's Party, especially strong in the South and the West, with a lot of working class support and a lot of poor farmer support. And they had actually elected a few senators, and they also elected a few governors and some members of the House of Representatives. Watson was a senator at this time. In 1898, that's when the U.S. went into this war against Spain to grab Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines and become an empire. But that isn't the story they fed to the people. They said, we got to go in just to help the poor Cubans who are being mercilessly treated by the Spaniards. So that's why we're doing this, just because we're so upset about the Cubans and their cotton and their tobacco and their sugar and the Philippines, which they never mentioned at all. They just went and sent an army and a fleet to the Philippines. Well, the war hype got stirred up, and this is what Watson observed, and this is what he wrote. The Spanish War has finished us reformers. The blare of the bugle drowns the voice of the reformer. Who gets the benefit of the war? This is Watson. The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads. National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust economic system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. This is 1898 now. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end up by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense. Republics can't go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And as you know, in every president, there's an emperor that's trying to get out, you know. Now, these guys don't quite have it just the way they want it, having said all this. They got really surprised and very seriously shaken up last January, February, December, January, February, March. You see, George Bush got a free ride into Afghanistan because of 9/11. A salute. There were some of us who did demonstrate against that war, but he really pretty much got what he wanted. He was fighting terrorism. He was supposed to have gotten the Taliban. He said the most single important thing is to get this Osama bin Laden, you know, the demonized individual we get. When he couldn't find him, he said, it's not important at all. It doesn't matter. Now, they expected the very same thing the next year. And that didn't happen. Rather, extraordinary things began to happen. And there are people in this room who played a good role in making that happen. But hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of people began to voice their objection and demonstrating all over the United States. Not just about the ones we heard about in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., but in L.A., in Seattle, in places all around the country. All over the world, people were demonstrating. In London, 2 million people, the largest demonstration in English history. In Spain, 81% of the people against the war. In Madrid, in every city, in every town, every night. You know, in Spain, nothing starts till about 10 at night. There are civilized people. Out there every night demonstrating against this war for weeks on end. In Italy, 78% of the people against the war. In Greece, 90-something percent of the people against the war. Demonstrations in every one of these countries. In Germany, Germans against the war, even the Germans. Finland, in Lithuania, in Indonesia, in Argentina, in Nigeria. In Mexico, Vicente Fox, just aching to be another lapdog for the American president, couldn't do it, right? Because all of Mexico was against that war. And in Japan, big demonstrations in Osaka, Kyoto, Tokyo, against the war, Indonesia. You could go on and on. All over the world, coordinated actions like this. This shook the hell out of the White House. These guys were really, they dropped that stuff about shock and awe. We'll go in, we're going to blow, hit everything, and just, the ones we don't kill will be left vegetables and we'll just stroll in then. They dropped that and they said, this is all for democracy. This is all for liberation, you see. And they've had to hold to that line. And today now they're caught in a people's resistance. They're subjected to something like anywhere from 10 to 20 attacks a day. They're losing, according to the U.S. commander, 3 to 6 men with 40 seriously wounded every week. They're in a war, a people's war now. And they could do real counterinsurgency, and they're doing some of it. They're killing a lot of Iraqis. They're rounding people up and they're shooting them. But they also can't quite do that. They have to keep this pretense that we're here as liberators, not occupiers. We're here to help these poor little backwood people. 5,000-year civilization, we're helping these poor little backwood people. Teach them how to rule themselves. We're doing all this stuff, you see. And so he's got the power. He's got the firepower. He's got the death delivery. He can go and destroy everything that's standing in Iraq, but he doesn't have the political power. He's faced with a political situation that we've created, and we've got him boxed in. And that's an important thing to remember. And when people say, oh, we demonstrated, and he had the war anyway, I said, I never doubted that this war would happen. These demonstrations weren't to stop the war. It was to contain it. It was to box them in. It was to hold them in and show them that the people are still there. And the people are very, very much in motion. Now, these were countries, what countries I'm talking about? Mexico, Japan. They have no historical or cultural link to Iraq, or religious or ethnic link. They were supporting this war for two reasons. One, out of regard for the Iraqi people, and two, out of regard for themselves, too. Because they were opposing the idea of this planetary monarch arising and saying, I shall decide who lives and who dies. We, the United States, now will honor no international treaties. They said that. These treaties are not to be honored. We will attack any country we want whenever we say, and when we deem that that country might be a menace or meets our disapproval. And we will reserve the right to be first to use nuclear power. And now look what he's doing. With overweening, utter arrogance, he turns to the UN, the same UN he was spitting at just last year, spitting at them and saying, you got to decide whether you're the United Nations or the League of Nations. We'll go in with or without you. We don't need you. And all the yahoos were saying, yeah, yeah, USA, whoa, whoa, as if they were watching a goddamn basketball game or something. But now he turns around and goes to the UN and asks them to help pick up the blood tab. pick up some of the blood on this and pick up some of the financial costs. And the UN is saying, that's very interesting. Oh, very interesting. You know he's lost political control when Kofi Annan, who jumps to anything the U.S. wants, who spends his whole life, yes, U.S. When Kofi Annan turns around and says, hey, this is the United Nations, we're not going to get into this kind of stuff. Go in, come in with us, but at an advisory role, and the U.S. calls all the shots. So how can you refuse an offer like that? And he says, we refuse. Kofi Annan said, we refuse. Because the people of the world have refused, and the people of the world are making themselves heard. And that's the important thing. That the people of the world make themselves heard, that we fight, that we struggle, that we go at this thing, that we don't compromise, we don't give up, we don't get discouraged, we just keep going. Well, some people say to me, oh, you got a conspiracy theory. Huh? I always run into that. Do you get that? You think these people intend to do this deliberately? I said, no, they're just sleepwalkers, and they just happen to say, they throw a dart at the map and say, well, let's attack Iraq. Yeah, that's a... Or let's attack this country there. Of course they plan. Of course they plan these things. I said, you really think there's a group of men sitting around in a room? Somehow that image really throws them out. Sitting around in a room and planning this? I said, oh no, they're not sitting around in a room. They're meeting on carousels, you know, and they're talking like that. And they're skydiving and they're holding hands saying, yeah, we got to do this, get a new Uruguay round and... increase the military budget and increase our profits and all that. Yeah, of course they sit around in rooms. Where the hell else you think they're going to sit around? They got plenty of rooms in the White House. They got plenty of rooms at the Council for Foreign Relations. They got plenty of rooms at the Bilderberg Conference. They got plenty of rooms at the Knickerbocker Club in New York, at the Bohemian Grove, and the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. You know, back in 1991, I looked at the... Bilderberg Conference attendees. They meet every, 2-3 years? Named after Bilderberg, the hotel where they first met. These are the ruling elites, the leaders, political, economic, corporate leaders with a few top media people and a few stray professors to write their position papers for them. A few little lackey hired prostitutes. Apology to the prostitutes who are working girls who don't have a choice in this thing. And I'm looking at this 1990, and so, you know, this big stack. And so I immediately, of course, I turn to the United States. I want to see who from the United States went to the Bilderberg Conference. The first name is no surprise. David Rockefeller of Rockefeller Brothers Association. Aren't you glad you got representation here in these world conferences? They're protecting our interests here, Ron. The second name really puzzled me and surprised me. I had heard of him. And I know he sent his National Guard down to Guatemala and seemed like one of those governors who was cozy with the CIA or something, but I knew nothing about him. It said, the Honorable Bill Clinton, Governor of Arkansas. I said, what the hell is the Governor of Arkansas doing rubbing shoulders and holding hands with David Rockefeller? And then six months later, I found out. He was suddenly in the media as the front runner Democratic candidate for President of the United States. He was the guy who was able to get WTO through a pass a Democratic Congress. So of course they plan, of course they are always planning, and we too have to organize and we have to plan. So remember that the empire achieves its goals by consuming the resources of the republic. The empire achieves its power by devouring the liberties of the republic. So the fight we face now, the struggle against U.S. globalism, is a struggle for the heart and soul of democracy itself. Thank you for your kind attention.